I am just going to say a few words before I bring Komang up here. And first off, I want to say thank you to the elders for allowing this to happen. This is a talk that has been a long time in the making, and I'm very happy and excited that we get to do it. And thank all of you for allowing us to start early, because I know that can be kind of chaotic. So I appreciate that. What we are going to do today... Over the past couple of years, you guys know I've been fellowshipping with Redeeming Grace Church, a Hmong church that meets at TCBC. And a lot of you ask questions about how that church is doing, and then you ask questions about the Hmong people. And I've always wanted to do those two questions justice. And so Komang has graciously agreed to come and speak to us. He's going to speak to us twice. So today is just part one. And what he's going to cover today, he's going to talk about who the Hmong people are and why they're here, because there's a lot of ignorance about who they are. And so we're going to clear some of that up. And then he's going to come back in July and speak about the actual church and how God raised that up and what he's doing there and tell us how that's going. Both of these stories are very important and very good. So I just ask that you listen real closely. And what we are going to do as well, we're going to try to leave 5-10 minutes at the end for Q&A. So please, no questions or comments till he's all done. But we'll open up the floor because this is probably going to generate some questions. Hopefully it does. I want to say a quick word about Komang before I bring him up here. I met Komang about 2 years ago. And Steve Drager, who's an elder at TCBC, called me up and said, "Paul, we're having a Hmong church that's going to be using our building on Sundays. And one of their leaders, Komang, you need to come and you need to meet him. I think he's someone you want to meet." And so we got together for lunch. This was about 2 years ago. And within 5 minutes, as soon as Komang started talking, I knew three things. I knew, number one, I was talking to a brother in Christ. You've all had that feeling before. You just know. And number two, I knew that my prayers had been answered, because I'd been looking for someone to work with my desires to reach the Hmong with the gospel. And number three, I knew that I had a lifelong friend that day. It was just one of those things. Things clicked right from the beginning. And Komang is a very gifted man, as you're going to see. He's gifted in a lot of areas. But what really impresses me most about him is his humility. As gifted as he is, he's very humble. And that's very humbling to me. I'm constantly, when I'm at the Hmong church, taken by the humility that's around me. And that's a real good thing. So I want to give Komang all the time he needs, so I'm just going to bring him up here. So this is Komang Lee, and he is one of the two elders at Redeeming Grace Church. Let me go ahead and put that on.
So, being Asian, I'm going to start with a generality, okay? Oftentimes, we're thought of as being very soft-spoken. And most of the time, that's probably true. So, today, I need somebody in the back to raise your hand if I start getting soft, okay? Okay. All right, so let me just speak up, and then we'll go from there. Can I just get a show of hands? When you see the word Hmong or you hear Hmong, how many know somebody who's Hmong or you've... Hmong? Okay. That's pretty good. All right. So what I'm going to do today is I'm going to give you, as the little subtitle says, a very brief history. There's a lot of history, but I'm only going to give you a little snippet, just enough so that you know enough to be dangerous. And then Paul will teach you some of the language, and then you'll really be dangerous. So what I want to do is I wanted, before I start, to just say a word of thanks. A word of thanks to all of you. A word of thanks to Paul. Obviously, a word of thanks to God Almighty that I have the opportunity to be here today, and as we go through this discussion, you'll kind of understand why I said that. And then, today Pastor talked about praying. And I know Paul's been very clear to me on this, that all of you have been praying for Redeeming Grace. So as a representative of Redeeming Grace, I just want to say thank you for all the prayers that you have been saying on our behalf, and trust and believe that God is working and that those prayers are being answered. So thank you very much. All right, so let's get going. I have a short amount of time. I'm supposed to talk really fast and really loud. So this is gonna flow. All right, so this is Asia. And the Hmong do not have a written history. So anything that is understood about our past is oral. So it's your grandmother, your grandfather, great-great-grandparents telling the next generation and trying to understand. This is starting to change. There are those now who have grown up in this country who are Hmong, and they are now starting to write some of the history. Hopefully we can accomplish that before those who are much older pass on and we no longer have that knowledge. But what I'm going to give you today, I wouldn't say is everything. I'm only going to give you the basics, because there's a lot from oral history. There's a lot of maybe somebody added something, somebody took something out. We're not completely quite sure because we don't have it written down. The only written history that we have might be from someone like the French were in Southeast Asia for many, many years. We have the Americans. So those who may have come in contact with the Hmong over the years may have written something about our history, but ourselves, we have not. Okay, so a lot of what I'm telling you today is more oral history and just trying to bring you guys kind of up to speed. Okay, so we want to start here in Asia. And although some say that the Hmong originally originated from Turkey, and Turkey, way over here, okay, the bulk of what I've heard from our own historians or other historians is it's more likely that the origination is somewhere here in China. Okay? So what happened is this. What happened is we were somewhere in China way before all of the Han and the Shang dynasties in China. So this is way, way back. Okay? And what happened is we've never had our own country. We've always been a minority in someone else's country. As the Chinese were trying to figure out who was going to take over China and who was going to unite all of China with all the different groups that are there in China, even today, the Hmong was just one of the groups that were in China at the time. And what happened is, let's just say we were kind of hard-hearted in the way that we looked at things. We liked our freedom. We liked being able to do what we wanted. Sound familiar to anybody? So we didn't like the fact that the Chinese were trying to unite everybody into one banner. We wanted to be autonomous. We wanted to be our own people. Some say that Hmong means free people. I'm not completely positive that that's completely true, but that's where it all started, is right somewhere, some part here in China was where it started. Now what happened is over the years, as things progressed in China, as the changes came, as the different dynasties came through, we as a people decided to support one group or another group. And sometimes we were right in supporting the right group, and sometimes we were wrong in supporting the and this will play again as I talk through our history. So as we chose the wrong groups to support, when they would lose power, we would get persecuted, and we would get pushed, and we were told to hurry up and submit and follow. And as they came, and as China united, the Hmong started getting pushed downwards in this area. So if you look very closely, you will see that in the red, that is Southeast Asia. Okay, so as we were in China and we were being pushed down, where we ended up is now we ended up in Southeast Asia. So Myanmar, which is also known as Burma, and then Laos, Thailand, Vietnam. So those four places is where the Hmong migrated to. Not all of us. Some decided that they wanted to remain in China, so they stayed in China. But a good chunk of the Hmong migrated down into Laos, Vietnam, and Burma, Myanmar. Everybody following so far? Okay. Now, I'm going to stop there. That's just to give you a little brief idea of where we may have originated from, how we ended up into Southeast Asia, which will tie into how we ended up in America. Okay? So now let's fast forward. So that was kind of back, way back history. Let's kind of fast forward to the time of the French. Now, Southeast Asia was a French-occupied area. And when the French occupied Southeast Asia, the Hmong were there already. This was prior to World War II. So we were already there prior to World War II. And when World War II came down, we didn't call, the Hmong did not call World War II World War II. We called it the Japanese occupation. Because this whole area was taken over by Japan during World War II. Okay? And during that time, we were recruited by the French to help fight the Japanese as they were in that area. And again, this will make sense a little bit later. So you'll know that where do we live? The Hmong lived in the mountains of Laos, the mountains of Vietnam, and the mountains of Burma. Okay? Why don't we live down in the valleys? Because we're farmers. We don't like people telling us what to do, and so we like to live out on the fringes, right? Well, nobody wants to live up in the mountains because you can't farm up in the mountains, and all of the valleys where all the big cities are, and that's where commerce is, and so why would you go hang out in the mountains? Well, we liked our little independence, and we liked being left alone, and so we liked the mountains. So that's where we stayed. So the Hmong tribes up in the mountains. So there you go. So that's how that's all laid out. Now, I'll talk about Vietnam and the Vietnam War a little bit later. But for now, let's transition a little bit. So now that you know a little bit where we originated, how we got down to Southeast Asia, I'm now going to talk more about Hmong as a people. So this is Laos. So here's Vietnam. Here's Cambodia down here. There's Thailand. There's Burma. There's China at the very top. And this is Laos. And Hmong, usually this area over here, is where the bulk of the Hmong were living, up by the mountains. Okay? Now let's talk a little about structure, family structure. Because I want you to get a feel of who we are as a people. When you talk about the Hmong, you have to start with the clans. So the clans, think of them as... The best way of describing a clan would be you have your Johnsons, and then you have your Andersons, and okay? And if you're all coming from the same source, meaning great-grandfather, then even though your names might be a little bit different, you still kind of see yourself as part of the bigger group. Well, the Hmong also track something very similar to that. So if you see these are the last names. This is spelled in Hmong, and only Paul would understand what that is. And then this is in English. You'll see that there's a bunch of last names on there. It's broken down by the 18 different clans that the Hmong have separated themselves into. Okay? I know it's very tiny. Sorry. But I had to fit all 18 on there. So we have the Fangs, the Hangs, the Hughes, the Hers, okay, all the way down. Every line is a clan, and every single clan may have different spelling of their last name. So, for example, you have the Taos, the Taos, the Thos, and the Thors. All are the Taos. To us, we understand them as the Taos. They may have spelled it differently once they got to America, but it's the same group. Okay? Now, this is important because this is how the whole people gets organized, is through these clans. So for me, my last name is Lee, so I'm in the Lee clan. And this is important because in the monk community, although we are very stubborn in our independence from others, in our own group, we are very interdependent. So there's a term in our own language, and it's called guti and nengcha. Okay, so I'll explain a little bit. Guti, translated literally, means brothers. Okay, it's the combination of older brother, younger brother. So you're taking the word for older brother, you're taking the word for younger brother, you're slapping the two together, and you're just getting brothers. Okay. Now, why is that important? It's important because what I've noticed in America is we're very individualistic. We're very into our immediate family. And extended family kind of gets lost in the shuffle as time goes on. Not if you're Hmong. Extended family does not get lost in the shuffle. Your great-great-great-grandparents with your extended great-aunt, with everybody, second cousin, third, fourth, fifth removed, okay, it doesn't matter. You know who they are. Why? Because they're kuti. You're all part of the same group. You all understand that. Okay? Now that's... Kuti is used for the father side of the family. Ningcha is used for the mother side of the family. And when you get married, I'll talk about this a little bit later too, but when you get married, it's not just two people getting married. It's two gigantic extended families getting married. Okay? So that's important to understand. Because as you look at this, you'll start to realize that how does the church fit into this? How does all of this work together? Okay, so I'm trying to lay the foundation here that the importance of the extended family is gigantic in our culture. There is no such thing as I'm going to live by myself. I'm going to move off to California. I'm going to ignore all of my extended family. Okay, you will be shunned. You will be in deep trouble. It just doesn't happen. You have to know who your extended family are. And then not only that, but not just your side of the family. I know sometimes we don't like the in-laws. No, sorry. You have to like the in-laws because you have to know every single one of the in-laws as soon as you get married. Okay? All the way to the extended family. Not just the immediate family, but the extended family. So that's huge. Okay? Number two, as a people, it's patriarchal. Okay? So the dad is in charge. And this is most clear if you go to Hmong gatherings, you will notice the men sit and talk together, the women sit and talk together. When it's time to eat, the women go and set up everything, and then they go and sit. And then the men go and sit, and the men get to eat. And when the men are done, then the women get to go and eat, and then the kids come. Okay? So that's just the way it's set up. That's the way it's always been. It's very patriarchal. Now, the other thing I want to mention here is also that it's not practiced much anymore. And I say much because there are some instances still in other countries, not so much in the U.S. But polygamy is also accepted. So it's a sign of wealth for the guys to have enough money to have multiple wives. And so they will. If they have the wealth, they will have multiple wives. And that's something that was practiced in the old culture. It's still practiced back in Laos and other countries. It's just not practiced here in the U.S. Okay? And if it is, okay, you get my end. You get my drift, right? If it is, you get my drift. All right, so that's the way it's set up. It's set up with the men being in charge, and then the women, and then the children. Okay? So I'm going to jump to giving you a better understanding, because we all know that family is the root of everything, right? That's in Christianity, you want to start with your family. The father needs to teach down. Okay? He needs to be a controlling, be in charge of the family, because that's the way God had set it up. Well, When it comes to weddings in the Hmong culture, remember I told you about the two big super clans, right? So whenever you're going to get married, there's always two negotiators from the wife's side of the family. There's two negotiators from the husband's side of the family. Okay, you come down and you talk. You talk about what? Well, they can talk for hours.
Arranged marriage? Is it arranged marriage?
Some of it is, some of it is not.
Okay.
Most of it would be. Nowadays, not so much. Okay, but the idea is, why do you need negotiators? You need negotiators because we're talking about a gigantic group of people on this side, a gigantic group of people on this side. There's a lot of, how do you put this, disagreements in the past? Okay? So they got to talk through this stuff. Oh, your second cousin removed, married into our family like 10 years ago, and now they got all kinds of issues, and we got to talk through that first. Before we let any more of our kids marry any more of your kids, we better figure this stuff out because there's something wrong here. Okay? Stuff like that, that's what they're talking about. So they're sitting there for hours talking about all of the past stuff because they pay attention to those things. You may not pay attention to it, but their side of the family have noticed it, especially if it's their person that's getting treated badly. They keep it in their back pocket because when you marry into their family next, it's coming up. Okay, so that's the stuff that's going on with the weddings. There's a lot of people that are invited to the wedding. Why? Because you have an extended family, right? So it's not just your immediate family, it's your extended family on this side, your extended family on this side. Let's just say that at my own wedding, I probably knew like 30% of the people there. And the rest of them, I have no idea who they are. I know they're related somehow, but that's the idea. The idea is that there's a lot of them, and there needs to be negotiations and an understanding and somebody accountable. So the two negotiators from each side, when they come and do that kind of job, they're saying they will be accountable, similar to what a pastor who is going to marry two people, you're kind of accountable. That's why pastors like to have them go through marriage, what's that called? Counseling, yes, before they will marry two people. You just don't want to marry anybody, right? So the same thing is true here. You have these four negotiators. If something was to go wrong later, you're going to call them back up. You're going to say, well, the kids are having issues. Can you guys come back out and can we talk this through again? Okay. So that's the structure for a marriage. Okay? And I know you guys got questions. I got to keep going. Okay? So we'll get to them as soon as we finish this stuff up. So there's your marriages. Okay? You've got these two huge groups of people getting married. You got to work through all of this. That's important because from this point going forward, you now not only just have your family you have to deal with, but now you have to be best friends with the other side of the family. Because every function that they have, they're going to invite you. And the expectation is you are going to attend. Because you are now married, not just your side of the family, but now you are in their side. The other thing that is also important is that because it's patriarchal, the daughter's side, or the bride's side of the family, back in the old days, would have lived most likely in a different village. And when she got married, she would have moved into her new family. She would have left all of her side of the family. Now, even though they still have influence over her, they're no longer responsible in a religious standpoint, from a providing standpoint. She is now a member of the new family. So everything from, and we'll touch on this a little bit later, on the religious side, like funerals, has to be handled by the new family. It's a cut. You are no longer part of the other family. You are now a part of this family. If you were to leave this family, the other family has to think twice before they take you back as well. Your own family. Okay? Because that's the way that it's looked upon. All right? So we have this whole dynamic going on with marriages. Is this idea? No. Hmong weddings take several days. The negotiators can go on for hours. Both sides of the family have representatives there to speak on their behalf. They will negotiate back and forth until they come up with a bride price. Yes, there is a bride price. So, the daughters are looked upon as... What's the best way to say this? They're looked upon as workers. Okay, you live in an agricultural type society. There's a lot of farm work. There's a lot of farm work to be done. Okay, so because of that, then every person that you have in your family is one worker. If you were to give up one worker to somebody else, then that means you have now one less than what you had before. And so what they do is they have a bride price so that you can help pay that particular family to help cover for that person no longer being there to work with the farm stuff. So that is something that, again, is practiced. Today, not so much. It depends on the parents. Some parents who are very traditional, they still practice that. Some parents who are not traditional, they no longer ask for a bride price. So it just depends. So they were told, choose wisely, right? But we know that already. We're usually supposed to choose wisely. So what you do is you throw a big fat party. You invite both sides of the family, and that's the wedding. Okay? You kill a pig, and you make as many dishes as possible with that fish, with that pig, and you're trying to feed a lot of people, right? You can just imagine how many people are going to be showing up to that wedding. And so this is just a little picture of just some people sitting there and eating. Now, I'm going to transition to something else, and this is funerals. I want to talk about weddings, I want to talk about funerals, because those two play a big part of the Hmong culture, is the weddings and the funerals. Those are the two big events in your lifetime that demand a lot of people to help you to accomplish those two things. And so this is these two events is the requirement for the Kutis and the Nengchas, for your huge extended family, because you're going to need a lot of people to be there to help cook, to help serve, to help clean. You're going to need a lot of people so these are the two big events. So you have funerals. Funerals, back then, and this is in Laos, this picture is in Laos, so obviously in America it's a little bit different than this, but I'm giving you an idea of what it used to be like. Back then, there is no such thing as a mortuary. There's no embalming. When somebody passes away, you put them in a casket or you put them out on display because people want to say their goodbyes, and you have to wait for the whole village and all the extended family to be able to come and say their goodbyes, and so the body will remain out for an extended period of time until it's done. Okay? With that, they have rituals that they have to perform. And if you add all that together, how long does a Hmong funeral usually take? It can take up to a week or longer. Okay? And who's feeding all these people who are coming? You are. Okay? So every day when they come, you're feeding them. Every day when they come to say their goodbyes, you're feeding them. So it's a very expensive endeavor as well. Okay? So this is just more pictures of some of the rituals that they're doing. You can see back here is actually where the body is being kept. And you can tell it's right out in the open. Again, more of the rituals that are going on. You can see the sheer mass of people. So there's a lot of people there during funerals. I wanted to show you this. This is something that is not as elaborate as this back in Laos. This is more of what people are doing now in America. What you're seeing in front of you, the structures that you see in front of you are all made out of paper. So the Hmong believe that once you pass away, you go on to a different realm. And in that different realm, you need money. This is money. So it's you take what is considered to us fake money. It's just paper, but it's paper that's colored in silver and gold, and you fold it into little trinkets. And what do they do with this? Is they burn it. So that's the same thing as you transferring from your account to your brother's account. Okay? It's that's what they're doing, is they're burning the money here to transfer the money to their person in the afterlife so that they have the money. So the bigger the display, the more money they're going to have. And so I've been to some funerals where the whole wall is full of this, and they burn all of it when the funeral is done. Okay? So you can see, it's made into different shapes. But the idea is that that's what they're going to do. There's only one big festival that the Hmong celebrate, and that is the Hmong New Year. And for those of you who have been here in Minnesota for a while, you've known that there's a Hmong New Year that is thrown, actually multiple ones that are thrown here throughout the year. This is a picture of the Hmong New Year, and this is in Thailand. So what the Hmong New Year is the Hmong New Year is a time for all of the Hmong to congregate to celebrate the New Year. For the older generation, it's a time to see your family, your relatives, your friends from other villages, because they all come to one to congregate to have the big Hmong New Year. So you get to see your family and your friends, your extended family. For the younger teenagers, anybody want to guess what Hmong New Year is for? It's about looking for your mate, right? It's about trying to see, because it's very hard to travel back and forth between the different villages, one day's walk, 2 days walk, but now they're all congregated in one place. You can see the line. All the guys and the girls are tossing balls back and forth. It's just a chance for you to talk to the opposite sex and get to know somebody who you probably would never seen before because you've never been to their village. Okay, so that's what the idea is. In the U.S., and back in Laos, but anybody recognize this? That's our old Viking stadium, right? That's the Metrodome. So you can see that there is also a sports event that is held at the very same time that the New Year is being held. So you're locked. So the Hmong are into volleyball, soccer mostly. So soccer, volleyball, and then there is also Katao. Anybody ever seen Katao? Think of soccer and volleyball mixed together with a ball made out of bamboo. That sounds like that would hurt. It does hurt. I've tried it. It does hurt. Okay? And that's how they do it. It's like playing soccer, so you can only use your feet and your head. Okay? No hands. And you're just kicking the ball back and forth between a net. And they jump and they flip and they kick the ball, and it's amazing stuff. If you ever want to watch it, just spell K-A-T-O, just type it into Google and you'll be amazed. All right, so this is also part of Hmong New Year. This is actually over at, I believe it's called McMenemy Field. It's over right across the street from Como Zoo. And this is the largest Hmong New Year in the nation here in the in Minnesota, houses the largest one in the nation. So during the 4th of July weekend, if anybody goes over in that area, you'll notice that it is completely blocked off. There is cars everywhere. That's the reason why, because they're having the Hmong New Year and they're having a full-blown soccer tournament, and everybody, Hmongs from all over the nation, are there. And so that's why you see a ton of people. And okay, Paul's been there. Paul knows what I'm talking about. During the Hmong New Year, they also have pageants, shows. Okay? So that's the big festival. That's the big one that the Hmong celebrate. Everybody still with me? You guys can still hear me back there? Okay. All right, I'm going to jump now and talk a little bit more about dress. Paul said, please, can you talk about the clothing? Because it's so beautiful. And I thought, oh, okay, we can talk about the clothing. So what I'm going to do now is I'm going to talk about clothing, and then I'm going to touch a little bit about Padao, which is the textile art that the Hmong do that most of you have probably seen, or if you haven't, you probably recognize it very quickly as soon as I start putting up some pictures. Okay, so what I'm going to start out with here is I'm going to give you what normally you would wear, because we may have given all of you the wrong impression, because you would have seen us in full dress and you're thinking, wow, they wear that all the time? And no, we do not. So this is what normally you would wear. Just giving you, so black, maybe a little, and you can't see it because it's black and white, but a little color with the sashes that they put on. Okay, but pretty much it's mostly black is what they're wearing. Okay? So that one's in color. So a little jewelry, but not expensive. Notice, who needs shoes, right? When it's that dirty, you don't need shoes. And then this is deceiving, because these are actually more formal dress, and so they must have wanted to stiff it up that day. The rest is normal, but the actual jewelry is more for formal. Yeah, I was waiting to see if somebody's going, aww. Okay. So this is going to be more now of getting dressed up. So this is what most have seen, is now you're getting more into the colors and you're getting more dressed up. So this is full-blown dressed for festivals. That's what you would wear to the Hmong New Year. That's to give you an idea of what the guys would wear. And you can see the jewelry. Okay, so I wanted to note something here. Paul's going to talk about this in a little bit, but notice the dress. It's got a lot of color. And then notice that dress is all white. There's two distinctions with the Hmong. There's what we call the white Hmong and the green Hmong. And the white Hmong, you can tell with in dress, they will wear white skirts. The green Hmong, they will wear the different colored skirts. Okay, and that's just something I want to kind of point out. You can see the money that's being those are coins that are being attached to the clothing. And again, it's a sign of wealth. The more coins you have, the wealthier you are. When you're walking, they can hear you, right? They can hear you coming down a mile away. Okay? So, that is not in practice anymore. Back in Laos, it was real coins. So they would literally drill into real coins and they would be wearing real coins. You could literally pick off of yourself and pay for stuff. Here, they're just using fake money. So you'll see it that they're wearing now, but it's not real money anymore. It's just fake money. So this is hand embroidered, and I'll show you that a little bit later. But I wanted just to show you some of the coloring. Now, the clothes that you see, what I'm going to show you next here is I'm going to show you that there's been a lot of influences from other countries, because the Hmong live in Vietnam, the Hmong live in Laos, the Hmong live in China. Okay, so because of those different countries that they live in, there's been influences with their clothing. So what you're seeing here is you're seeing the Hmong who are living in Vietnam. So they have altered their clothes a little bit. And so just by looking at it, you can tell that, okay, it's a little bit different. Very similar idea, but a little bit different. This is Thai. So this is the Hmong in Thai. This is a shirt that a guy would wear. And so you can see the embroidery that's in the front. This is Chinese. That's Chinese. And just a note, the travel group or area of China has latched on to the Hmong recently because of the elaborate clothing and the silver jewelry that we like to do. And they have now used that as a major marketing thing to try to convince people to go to China to kind of go see this sort of stuff. So the next few ones I'm going to show you are what the Chinese have gotten very used to now, saying, okay, look at this. You know, don't you guys want to come and see this? Look how beautiful that is, kind of thing. Okay, so this is the Hmong in China. And yes, that is elaborate silver hats.
Whoa.
So this is there's about three or four very well known Hmong singers in the China musical scene right now. And so this is stage dress. So this is what they would wear when they're up on stage singing. And she's one of them. She's the other one.
Not Britney Spears.
And that's the other one. And it's so exciting that even Brad Pitt got into it. So yeah, that is the Hmong shirt. Okay. So this is what it is. It's cross-stitching by hand. So a lot of the older ladies, this is what they sit around and do. It takes a lot of time. They're working through it. It's all by hand. That's just to show you. It's just really just a cross-stitching. And then this is the Pa Dao that some of you probably have seen already. It's really just a piece of fabric that you have cross-stitched and you have sewn the borders. And then this is the other version where it's the story cloth, where you're telling a story. And that's the elaborate one about the story of the Hmong. So what do they do? Well, back in Laos, obviously, there's two big ones. You've got rice paddies. Some have actually credited the Hmong as the ones who started the whole rice thing all through Asia. I don't know if I would go that far either. But so this is rice paddies. So a lot of time, a lot of people spend their days working in rice paddies. And then the other one is just farming. So I asked my mom and I said, Mom, what's the deal with land? So if you guys are farmers and if you're going to farm, do you have to buy land from somebody? How does that work? She goes, no. You're in the mountains of Laos, right? Who wants to live in the mountains of Laos? Nobody. So, who owns the land up in the mountains of Laos? Nobody cares. So, all you do is you go and say, all right, I like that spot. If it doesn't belong to anybody, if nobody's house is sitting there, if nobody's farm is sitting there, then you go and you what? You cut the trees. Right, so you cut down all the trees, you pull out all the stumps, you burn the place down, because that they practice slash and burn. So they slash and then they burn it. And then the very next year, they till the ground and they use it as their farm. And then now it becomes your land. You just put your little house up and then you're good. Okay? So there's a lot of farming. So everybody does farming. Water buffaloes? Okay. The other thing then, and you guys have seen it, the farmers markets. Okay, so if you're going to be a farmer, you got to find some way of selling the produce. Well, if you're into textiles, there you go. You go and you sell the textiles. And then this is just some shots of markets where they're selling the clothes, they're selling the stuff that they've made by hand. And then that's the produce. So you bring your little amount of produce that you've made for the day, or and then you try to sell it. Okay. Now, I'm going to jump to religion. So I'm going to be brief about this, and then we can talk some more later. That's a shaman. So the Hmong are what some consider ancestor worship. Some call it animism. Others call it shamanism. It's kind of a mix of the three. So what they believe is they believe in definitely two groups. There's the spirits, and then there's the living. And the interactions between the two groups is what causes certain things. Okay? So number one, you worship your ancestors because once they pass away, they're spirits. They are now spirits. And so then you have a shrine to them, or you if stuff goes wrong, it might be that your great-great-grandmother is upset at you, and that's why you're sick. And so what you want to do is you want to ask the shaman to come out and talk to your great-great-grandmother and say, hey, what's going on? Why are you upset with them? And then the shaman will come back and say, yep, she says that you didn't feed her enough this past week. And so then, so to remedy that, I just need to get some stuff. I need to go and put it at her gravesite. And then she's going to be happier now, and then I won't be sick. So he is the medium between this, the physical, where we all live in, and the spiritual. That's what his job is partially that. Partially, they do look at him as a healer. And that's how he heals, in the sense that he communicates with what is going on, whether it be an ancestor of yours or whether it be just a spirit that you upset. Okay? And the reason why they also say animism is when you believe that inanimate objects have spirits in them, like trees and bushes and cars and, okay, grass, all right? So same idea. You might be walking in the woods and you cut off the wrong tree and you upset the spirit of that tree. And they might do something bad to you. That kind of a thing. Okay? And then shamanism is just, again, because we're using the shaman as the medium between the two worlds to communicate. Okay? The other big religion is Christianity. So you're either one or the other. So you're either into the traditional religion, or you have converted into Christianity. Those are really the only two. There is a little hint of Buddhism because of where we had lived for so long. There is a lot of influence from Buddhism, but most of it is pretty much Christianity or why am I losing my train of thought? Christianity or traditional. Okay? All right, there's a lot more stuff that I could talk about there, but I'm going to stop for a moment. I'm going to let Paul take over.
Skip the language part.
Okay. So that was Paul's language part. Nyo Jong is hello. Kongpli is gift. Kikul Gu is history. And Hmong is spelled H-M-O-O-B. As you guys can tell, it's using the English letters because we never had a written language. It's always been oral. And it was actually, was it the French?
Three men. A Catholic priest, a Christian missionary, and a Christian linguist from Bethel College, right here in Roseville.
Okay. So three men, a Catholic priest,
Christian missionary,
Christian linguist from Bethel College. Those three came up with the idea that, okay, let's put your sounds into English letters, and then you guys can now write your language. And that's how we have the language, and that's why it's in English letters. Okay? All right, so with the short time that I have left, I'm going to go over the reason why we're here. Okay, so now that we know who the Hmong are, roughly, I want to give you an idea of why are the Hmong in the U.S. The Hmong are in the U.S. because of the Vietnam War. So if you remember what I said to you, the Hmong sided with the French during World War II to fight the Japanese when the Japanese were there. When Vietnam started happening, what happened was the CIA said, we have an issue. Our fight is with Vietnam in Vietnam. But Vietnam is trying to build the Ho Chi Minh Trail through Laos as a way for them to transport from North Vietnam to South Vietnam. We need somebody in Laos who is going to disrupt that trail. We cannot let them finish that trail. We cannot let them use that trail. We need somebody who's going to attack them and bother them. That's one of the reasons. So they said, okay, who are we going to find? We need somebody in the mountains because that's where the trail is going through. So obviously the French and the U.S. are allies. So the French said, hey, we got a solution for you. We have some allies of ours back in the World War II days. They're called the Hmong. They live up there. They know that place backwards and forwards. You need to go talk to them. They will be your allies. And so the CIA came to us, and the CIA said, okay, here's the deal. We're going to win this war. And when we win this war, you guys are going to get your own country. But we need your help. We need your help to stop this from happening, this Ho Chi Minh Trail. Not only that, but we want you, because we're going to have pilots flying through that area. They're going to get shot down. So U.S. pilots, you need to be the group to go get them when they get shot down over Laos. Not only that, we have relay stations for radar that we're going to put up. We need you to defend those stations. Okay? You guys know how to fight. You fought before. So we'll supply the guns. We'll supply the food. We'll supply all the stuff that you need. We'll supply the money to pay for your soldiers. You just need to find the people to defend this area and be an ally of the U.S. Okay. The reason why you have never heard of this is because it's called the secret war. It's because it's done by the CIA. The CIA is what? Secretive. They're not going to tell you about this stuff. Okay? It's only been within the last 5 or so years that they've actually declassified a lot of this, and it's starting to come out. So if you go on YouTube or you go out on the internet, you'll start to see this stuff show up now. But before now, if you look into your history books, you are never going to see anything that says this. Because this is covert, right? Covert means you don't need to know about it. So that is what happened. So we were an ally of the U.S. We fought on your behalf, well, I should say our behalf, during this time period. Okay? This is Long Chinh. Long Chinh was the main base of the Hmong army. That's the airstrip that all the airplanes would fly through and drop off supplies, guns, and so forth, so on. Okay? This is another picture of Long Chinh. This is where the bulk of the work was done. This is where the general of the Hmong people, Vang Pao, who passed away several years ago, that's where his base was. That's where the bulk of the people were. Okay? The guy standing right there is General Vang Pao. That one. I know it's not kind of clear. These were really small pictures. I had to blow them up, and so they're not as clear as they probably could have been. That's Vang Pao again in the hat. And if you're wondering, hey, he looks a little young. Yes, 13 and up, you're in the army. Okay, if you have a lot of sons, they're coming, and because it's clan structured, all the leaders of the clans are responsible for a certain amount of people to participate in the military. So they're going to come and talk to you, and they're going to say, how many sons do you have? if you have five sons, we need three of them. You can keep two, but we're going to take the other three. Okay, so they go as young as 13, if not younger, who are carrying guns and fighting in the army. These are the Hmong pilots. One of them is actually going to our church. He's my brother-in-law. And their story is amazing, but I don't have time to tell you guys today. Let's just say that you were handed a manual for the airplane. That's the airplane they're driving. You're handed the manual, so you have to kind of know how to read English, because it's in English. There is no practice time. Okay, you read the manual, you go in there, you fiddle with the gadgets, you take off, and you don't expect to come back because they never taught you how to land. Okay? That is what the pilots were meant to do, okay? Is to go. And the way that these airplanes, you cannot shoot the guns in the front. You cannot shoot the guns from way up high because you can't hit anything. So you got to fly low so that you can shoot. So they also have to learn how to fly low, which means the chance of them getting killed is a lot better because you're closer to the ground, so they can actually shoot you down, right? So that's the pilots. So there's another picture. That's General Vangpah. When the U.S. Army called him and said, oh, sorry, we're pulling out. I'm just kidding. That's not one. That's just him talking on the... But that's what happened. Okay? The U.S. said, oops, sorry, this is not going to work. We have to leave. And so when the U.S. pulled out, he was notified that the U.S. was pulling out. Because he had access to planes and other things, he transported his family, he flew them over to Thailand. And then he said, announcement to all Hmongs, the U.S. is stepping out. That means, if you want to get out, I only have a certain amount of planes. They're going to be coming in to that airway, that airport at certain times throughout the day. Get on that plane if you want to get out. There's only going to be a few of them. We only have enough gas for a certain amount of rounds. And so whoever gets on the plane gets to go. You can see all of the people trying to get on the plane. Okay, this is actually the shot of the very last plane and the group of people that were getting on that plane. Now, in that war, of all the men that were estimated, I think the Hmong must have lost close to a third of the men during that war. So this is all the families trying to get on that plane. Now, once that last plane took off, you were out of luck. There is no more planes coming. And so you had to make a decision. Either you stay in Laos or you leave. If you leave, the best place to go is Thailand, because Thailand was right next door and Thailand was an ally of the U.S. And so if you wanted to go, that was probably the best place to go. You don't want to go to Vietnam. You don't want to go to Cambodia. You don't want to go any of those other places. You want to go straight to Thailand. So it began the massive exit. So you had to make a decision. And I talked to my parents about this. You had to decide. Either I'm going to be communist and join the Vietnamese because they're coming through. So either I'm going to switch to communism and I'm going to be part of them and I'm going to say, I'm so sorry, I messed up. Forgive me. Or you're going to step out. And if you step out, you're going to go to Thailand. Now, there has been word that if you do go to Thailand, there is a chance that you might be going somewhere else. That the United States and its allies may be willing to take in refugees if you get to Thailand, so they can actually fly you out. So this is a picture of families deciding, okay, better yet, let's just leave. Obviously, those who are going to move first are going to be those who were part of the military. Because if you were part of the military, they're coming after you first. So obviously, you and all of your family are probably leaving. Any relatives of those who were in the military? And what are we talking about? Extended family again? Okay? Then you're probably thinking, okay, I better get going too. Because so you can tell that there is also fear. fear of the unknown. Fear of, okay, this is where we've always lived. This is what we've always understood. What is there for us in Thailand? What is there for us outside of Thailand? We have no idea where we're going. Let's just... Okay, so this is them exiting. In that picture, I'm not going to go back to it, but in the picture, if you look at Laos and you look at Thailand, there is a big river that runs in between. That's the Mekong River. That is a very wide, a very deep, a very fast-flowing river. If you have money, and back then it would be gold or silver. If you have gold or silver, then most likely you're planning on paying whoever the boatman is by the shore to transport you over. If you do not, or you're under the cover of night, you're trying to run away and try not to get shot, then there have been multiple families that have tried to cross on their own, just swim across. And there has been families, complete families, that have been lost because they tried to swim across the Mekong River and they got caught in the current and they never made it to the other side. So all of that is part of what was going on. So now, this was the refugee camp that was in Thailand. It was one of them. Before we came to the U.S., every person was taken, your picture was taken, your name was put on there, and the number that they have assigned to you. And so these are all the pictures. This was an exhibit in California where they took all of their pictures in the past and they put up in this exhibit. So this just gives you an idea. Once you get to the refugee camps, once you get to the refugee camps, then you can put your name up for coming to the U.S., if that's what you would like to do. So you would add your name to the list. If they call you, then they would bring you. First come, first serve. Whoever wanted to go to the U.S., you put your name down, they will send you to the U.S. But there's a lot of apprehension, right? A lot of scary people saying scary things. Let me just give you guys a couple that I thought was humorous, but hey, if you didn't know any better. In America is the land of giants. Okay? You go there, they're just going to eat you. Okay? Stuff like that. So you have all of your other relatives who decided to stay, and then you have the ones who are deciding maybe they want to go, and they're all trying to make up their mind which way to go. If you decide to go and you put your name and your name gets drawn and they call you, then you get on the bus and you go to the airport. Now, why here? That's the location of the four refugee camps that are in Thailand. They no longer exist. The last one was shut down several years ago. All of the Hmong that were still in there were asked to go back to Laos. Okay, so there's no more. This is the U.S. This will give you an idea of where the Hmong are. The dark blues is where there is more than 5,000. And this is back in 2000. So this was way back. So more than 5,000. As you can see the different colors, you can see that Minnesota, Wisconsin, Michigan, California, and North Carolina are where the bulk of the Hmong are in the U.S. And then the others are sporadic all over the U.S. Okay? Why is this important? Well, I wanted to give you guys this because Paul wanted me to give you an idea of... Paul said, Komang, you have to tell them why the Hmong are here in the U.S. Because a lot of U.S. citizens do not know why the Hmong are here. I know it sounds funny, but a lot of times all Asians kind of look similar. So you look at them and you go, well, they're all the same. Well, okay, no. Right? Just like every Caucasian that I see, they're not the same. Okay? So the Hmong are here because of the Vietnam War. The Hmong are here because of us being allies with the U.S. during the Vietnam War. The Hmong are here because if we weren't, we would either be communists or we'd be dead. And so that's the reason why we're here. Now, not only the U.S., but the U.S. had allies. So France accepted a lot of refugees. Australia accepted some refugees. So we're sparse all over the world. Okay? Because you don't have a country, that's kind of where we ended up. So I wanted to end with this because my time is way over. God is an amazing God. And when you think about this, and I'll talk a little bit more about this in my next presentation, but the providence of God is something that you have to just stop and be in awe of. We were living in the mountains somewhere. Yes, was there access to God? Yes, there was. Were there missionaries that came? Yes, there were. Okay? But not the kind of access that you have here in the United States of America. And a large percentage of the Hmong were moved, picked up, and dropped off here in the United States. And so this, to me, when I look at this, yeah, it's tragic. Yeah, when you look at it, it's scary stuff. My parents still don't talk that much about it because they lived through it. But when I look at it from God's perspective, He always has a reason for what He's doing. And the reason is beyond our understanding. But now looking back at it, the stuff that I have access to now, the things that I can do for God now, is massive compared to what I might have been able to do if I was still back in Laos. And so, to me, I just want to give you guys a sense. This is more for education, so that you now understand why the Hmong are in the United States. There has been many waves. It all started back in about 1975. The first wave came, and then multiple waves after that. Since then, it has stopped. I think the most recent one was 1990-something, was the last wave of Hmong refugees that came to this country. Then the U.S. shut it off, and the U.S. said, okay, that's enough. But I wanted to leave everybody with that sense of hope and understanding that is what this is for. God has a purpose. He has a grand purpose. We are obviously part of it, or else we would not be in His plan. And so hoping that between all my brothers and sisters and us, we can help achieve God's plan for His glory. Okay, so I'm going to stop.